second, those rays hit your body. Also, we should see that because some cosmic rays are so energetic that I would say that they should cancel each other. We should not even see them. I mean, I have to think how to explain it, but let's see first.
Those cosmic rays are bombarding us continuously, and at first you would say, boy, they're a big disadvantage. Thank goodness we've got this atmosphere and this magnetic field on this planet acting as a shield. And 99.99% of all those cosmic rays do not get to you. A hell of a lot of them get through because they're so energetic. I mean, our most powerful particle accelerator, the Large Hadron Collider, doesn't come close to the amount of energy that comes through many of those cosmic rays hitting us continuously. The cosmic rays look like they're a disadvantage, but it's an ill wind that blows no good is one of the expressions you'll sometimes hear. Those cosmic rays hitting your body continuously probably are the major mechanism that slightly scrambles your DNA code continuously, and it probably is one of the major mechanisms that creates the changes from one evolution, from one generation of human beings to the next, different than your father and mother's DNA being combined. There's an extra random variable being thrown in there by way of cosmic rays, and that mechanism is probably one of the main mechanisms that creates the evolution. It creates changes from generation to generation that look like a random variable that wasn't planned. It wasn't part of the original DNA and the way the male and female gamete came together. As such, 99% of the time, that change is a disadvantage. 1% of the time, that change, I'm just picking numbers out of the air when I give you those percentages, 1% of the time, that change, that random variable, is an advantage. And that particular offspring has a greater chance of survival, and therefore he stands a chance of passing on that advantage to his offspring. And so you look at the fossil record of all of the plants and animals that have occurred on this planet, and tremendous numbers of them went extinct, but you see a continuous improvement in the survivors. And as such, cosmic rays are probably the major causative agent. At least that's one of the hypotheses right now. It may not be the only one, but it's certainly one of the ones. A changing environment and adapting to the environment is another one. So even the disadvantage of the cosmic rays, which are in theory rather damaging, they do something good. And so detecting them, I mean, you can call the particles. Let me drop.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Everything that's transmitted through space, is it a particle or is it a wave? And the answer is yes. It's both, depending on what detector you use and how you decide to study it. As you go to higher and higher amounts of energy, it does appear to become more and more of a particle. That's one way of looking at it. So these cosmic rays, I think in many cases, are the nucleus of some kind of an element, accelerated at some speed way beyond what you can do with a Large Hadron Collider, and it comes zooming down toward the Earth, hits some of the upper atmosphere, and it's like a bowling ball hitting a bunch of pins. It's hitting atmospheric molecules and scattering them, and sometimes it scatters those pins in the bowling alley, so to speak, with such energy that still the secondary and third and fourth and fifth bounces, so to speak, of those bowling pins still contain a tremendous amount of energy when they come down to Earth. And it's not too difficult to build a detector to measure those cosmic rays. I've seen, whenever you go to an open house at Brookhaven Laboratory, from time to time they'll show you some of the early cosmic ray detectors they built. And for a guy who likes to do homebrew, do it yourself, some of those wouldn't be very difficult to build. And some of them are really a cosmic ray telescope. They not only tell you how many hits per second are taking place, give you a pretty strong hint as to what was the direction of arrival by knowing how it went through the five layers of your particular detector and which one of the individual elements of that layer did it hit. Therefore, you know what direction it came from. You'll be surprised to find that some of them come from straight down below you. So, did they really come through the Earth? I kind of doubt it, except for neutrinos, but the radioactive materials in the Earth are also giving off rays that can be detected. Fun stuff, as you can tell. No matter what part of the spectrum you study, let me drop. We think that some of the most valuable instrumentation to figure out where we are in the universe is an optical telescope. And boy, we've learned a lot. And no matter what telescopes we've got, we always wish we had more of them and they were bigger with more sensitive photoplane, photocoupled diodes and whatever, photocoupled devices on the detector of the telescope. As you build bigger and bigger telescopes and you look further and further into space with an optical telescope, you see more and more. And you get more and more mysteries and more knowledge. But optical astronomy, from roughly 400 to 700 nanometers, is just one little piece. You can use infrared, near infrared, far infrared, high radio, low radio astronomy. That's going down in frequency. You can go up in frequency to ultraviolet and eventually X-rays and cosmic rays and gamma rays. So there's a tremendous spectrum, literally from DC to cosmic ray. We used to call it DC to light, DC to cosmic ray. Every one of those possible frequencies. If you're smart enough, you can build a telescope and take a look at what's out there and what's in here. Telescopes, microscopes, boy, they give us an awful lot of information. And sometimes they make some very pretty pictures. Dave, N2APG, and I just can't get enough optical devices. He collects binoculars and telescopes. I collect a few binoculars and telescopes. I just collected another telescope this week. As many as I've got. I wish I had one more of them. Bigger ones, smaller ones, more compact ones, more transportable ones, and so on. Sometimes I use them to look at the top of my tower from 200 feet or 150 feet away. I can, with the right kind of a telescope, I can zoom in on that 1032 or quarter 20 screw at the top of the tower and look at those particular threads and decide what tools up.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I can sit there on the ground and look at every foot of the tower, the 100-foot tower, Rhone 55G, and decide which one of the antennas need repair, what size tool I need to operate on that particular antenna. You could plan a lot of the operation on the ground with a good telescope. I'm amazed that I've never read articles about people doing that. A lot of people climb up there and say, gee, I wish I had the so-and-so tool. With proper planning, I can figure that out ahead of time with a telescope on the ground. So my telescopes are not only used for astronomical observing, I do an awful lot of terrestrial observing. And there's a whole lot of story to that one, too. Okay, anybody with any further questions or comments on this subject, hold them first. Let me go back to John for one more of his mailbag, and then we'll go back open to questions again. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. KC2WGB. Very well, Dick. Okay. Now you're going to put your thinking cap on. Back in the Stone Age, when you and I were young, HP made a device, the 200 generator, which was the audio frequency generator, which was extremely stable. I helped a young man repair one over the internet, and the problem was the lamp, which I think was at number 47. That was in the feedback circuit of the oscillator and controlled the frequency and did a very good job. He would like to know exactly how that works. Maybe you can explain to him about the lamp and how the resistance changes and how that is fed back to the oscillator. And that is what stabilizes the frequency. He's really interested in that because he was amazed. The light never comes on, but it is not stable without the lamp. So he's all confused. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, Mr. Hewlett and Mr. Packard in Palo Alto, California, in their little one-car garage way back in, I'm not sure the exact year, but I'm going to guess it was around 1950, Let me think now. What was that again?
49.
I guessed 50. And there's a reason I guessed 50, because my first job in 1958 used that exact instrument, a Hewlett-Packard Model 200 audio signal generator. And I made some guesses as to how old it was. So 1949, these two very crafty ham-like guys, which didn't have a ham license at the time, to my knowledge, in this garage, assembled this thing called a Wainbridge audio oscillator, is what I call it, the HP Model 200. And that particular garage is now a national shrine that has been preserved. This multi-billion dollar company called Hewlett-Packard had its origin in Palo Alto in that garage. If you look at a good book called Reference Data for Radio Engineers, and it's now in its sixth edition, I think it is, or seventh edition. I've got every one of the editions. And if you look at bridge circuits, and you look at something called Wainbridge, Mr. Wein, W-E-I-N, I think it's spelled, came to the conclusion that if you take these, if you start off with what looks like a diamond, a four-sided thing, but you didn't set it up as a square, you tilted it 45 degrees, so you call it a diamond, and each one of the four sides of the diamond contains a capacitor or inductor or resistor. When you set it up just right, across the two opposite nodes of that diamond, you've got this so-called bridge-like circuit. What it does is when you choose the right inductors and capacitors, you have selected the exact frequency. Put a amplifying tube around it. Let me backtrack and tell you what that is for. Every single circuit that you and I call oscillator really is an amplifier with feedback. You feed back the signal coming out of the amplifier back to its input, carefully adjust the phase and or a frequency selective device, and now you've got what you and I call an oscillator. So an oscillator with frequency tuning device and feedback is called, an amplifier with feedback is called oscillator. Okay, the R's and C's you set up in the resistors and capacitors you put into that Wainbridge determines the exact frequency. However, there's a catch. Every oscillator is an amplifier with feedback. That's step number one. Step number two, the total loop gain. If I walk through the amplifier once, come out of the amplifier, take some of that signal, feed it back to the input, and walk through the amplifier the second time, the signal coming through the amplifier the second time has to be a tiny bit stronger than the first time. The total loop gain must be above unity, otherwise you don't start oscillating and you don't keep oscillating. So you've got to have the loop gain just a tiny, tiny bit above unity. But now there's a catch. Each time the signal goes around, it's going to get stronger and stronger. Obviously, it's going to get so strong, it's eventually going to saturate your amplifier. You want your amplifier to make this beautiful sine wave at the exact frequency you've determined with your Wainbridge circuit. The Wainbridge is determining the frequency. But now the amplitude is going to infinity. It's going to hell and gone. You've got to do something to limit the amplitude. The genius of these guys is they decided to put in the feedback network, which usually exists in the back of the old days when the Wainbridge oscillator consisted of a tube amplifier, in the cathode of that tube.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You normally would ground the... Let me drop long enough. You normally would ground the cathode with a resistor. You want the resistor to be small enough that the loop gain is above unity. You want the resistor to be large enough that the amplitude of oscillation doesn't go to infinity. Between a rock and a hard place. They rapidly discovered with their volt-ohm milliammeter, the old-fashioned triplet or Simpson volt-ohm milliammeter, these guys are smart enough to measure an ordinary light bulb. That 100-watt light bulb, incandescent light bulb, you used to use in your room. When it's got exactly 120 volts across it and is drawing very close to 1 ampere and therefore creating 100 watts of input power, it has an internal resistance ohms when it's hot. But the filament of that light bulb, when it's cold, is more than 10 to 1 lower in resistance. That 120 ohm resistance of your 100 watt light bulb is less than 10 ohms when it's cold. You put your ohm meter across there and measure 10 ohms, you think you've got a 1,000 watt light bulb. When it gets hot, the resistance jumps from 10 ohms to 120 ohms, and it's a 100 watt light bulb. So the resistance of a light bulb changes very rapidly with temperature. So if you're smart enough to put a light bulb as the resistor from cathode to ground of a tube-type oscillator, it does the amplitude control for you. It starts off with 10 ohms. I'm assuming now I'm using a 100-watt light bulb. They're using something different. But in my example, I got 10 ohms from cathode to ground. The circuit has got 5 dB too much gain. It starts off and oscillates like crazy. The oscillation amplitude builds up to a bigger and bigger sine wave. There's now more and more sine wave appearing between cathode.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
There's more and more signal now appearing from cathode to ground on the tube type circuit. Therefore, more and more heat occurs in the filament of the bulb. The filament gets hot. The resistance goes up. The gain of the amplifier goes down, and it automatically balances. You'd be amazed if you've ever built any kind of an oscillator where you'd expect to have a pure sine wave, and you're looking on a good oscilloscope at the quality of the sine wave coming out of your oscillator circuit. It takes you about 1 hour to discover that it's extremely difficult to make a pure sine wave oscillator, to make a square wave oscillator, a triangle wave oscillator, any kind of a non-linear waveform is easy. To make a pure linear sine wave as an oscillator, very difficult. You've got to, when it is running in the pure sine wave mode, there's an exact amplitude of volts coming out of that oscillator. If you're supplying 100 volts to the plate of that tube, you probably can't get more than about a 30 volt peak-to-peak sine wave out of it with reasonable linearity. So now you want, in that example of 100 volts going to the tube plate, you want exactly a 30 volt peak-to-peak sine wave coming out. And how do you get 30 volts? It wants to go to infinity. How do you get exactly 30 volts? You have to have this feedback network called light bulb where its resistance changes in just the right ratio as a function of voltage so that if it goes to 31 volts, the tube gets a little bit too hot, the resistance goes up, and the gain starts going down. If it goes down to 29 volts, the tube cools off a little bit, the resistance goes down, the gain goes up, and it goes back up to 30 volts. It's a beautiful servo mechanism. The thermal time constant of that light bulb is somewhere around a second. So within 1 second, it does a beautiful job of adjusting the amplitude of your sine wave. When you adjust the model Hewlett-Packard
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you take that Hewlett-Packard Model 200 sine wave oscillator, which goes from something like 10 hertz up to around a megacycle, the original one, half a meg, 1 meg, 2 megs, in that order. When you go to the lowest possible frequency, 10 hertz, the first time you go down there, and if you're looking at the output on an oscilloscope, you'll watch the amplitude of the sine wave it makes jump up and down for a while. It takes it about 10 seconds to settle down. At the lowest possible frequency, there's so few sine waves going into that light bulb circuit that it takes a longer period of time for it to settle down. But at reasonable frequencies, like 1 kilohertz, it settles down in a fraction of a second. Does a beautiful job. So that light bulb and its change in resistance as a function of voltage is adjusting not the frequency, the amplitude. And there's an extremely precise gain of the loop required. When it finally settles down and is completely stable in amplitude, and you do a very careful study, what is the loop gain? It is 1.00000. You can't get any closer to unity of loop gain. If it was a microvolt above that, the amplitude would increase. If it's a microvolt below that, the amplitude would decrease. It settles on a very exact number where the loop gain is one point with as many zeros as you can put after it. And such a simple circuit does a lot. light bulb. They try to do that with field effect transistors and rectifying diodes and whatever. I've been down that road. It is a tough problem. KC2WGB, K2LAW, the TechNet.
Beautiful answer, Dick, because I worked with him over the internet with this problem about 2 weeks ago, and I told him to listen within the next couple of weeks because I was going to present it. I'm glad I found that article that I wrote down, that little note, because he was having a very difficult time understanding the lamp and the fact that it wasn't lighting. What could it be doing? So that's perfect. I'm sure he has a grasp of it now, better than I could have explained it to him. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
So the most difficult oscillator in the world to build is a pure sine wave. Nowadays, with direct digital synthesizing techniques, you really are doing it with a pre-programmed staircase-like generator where the steps of the staircase are so fine that in theory you can't see the steps on the oscilloscope anymore. You put it into a very good spectrum analyzer and you'll see the effect of those staircases immediately as higher harmonics. If you build a sine wave oscillator where it's got 1,000 steps and you set it for 1 kilohertz sine wave and there's 1,000 steps in there, with your spectrum analyzer looking at the 1 kilohertz output of your oscillator, you will see a component at 1 megacycle, 1,000 times higher in frequency, and 1 megacycle, and 3 megacycles, and 5 megacycles. Square waves make odd harmonics. So you think you're generating 1 kilohertz, and if you do a real good job, the 1 megacycle undesired spurious output will be 60 decibels down, and the 3 megacycle output will be 66 decibels down, and so on. Maybe it's 69. They get weaker and weaker, but they will be there. To build a pure sine wave oscillator with no other frequency but your desired frequency is what that very simple circuit that made them a fortune. It set in motion one of the most successful electronic engineering companies in the United States, if not planet Earth. The total number of products are very high quality. I mean, when I first cut my teeth on electronics in 1958, my very first job was at Telephonics Corporation in Huntington, and they were using that Weinberg oscillator to measure the quality. Let me drop. To measure the quality of the aircraft intercom systems they were manufacturing at the time. I was in the final testing department. That was my first job. We were taking that Weinberg oscillator, pouring a given amount of 1 kilohertz through these amplifiers that were being used as an aircraft intercom system, and with a distortion analyzer made by Hewlett-Packard, you measured how much harmonics were being generated by the amplifier. You were looking at the quality of the amplification of the amplifier that's going to go on an airplane for an aircraft audio intercom system so that the pilot could talk to the tail gunner, so to speak. That's what that system was doing. And I was so excited by this. I knew that they had a couple of manuals. The Hewlett-Packard manuals were sitting on a shelf in another room. I went to the other room, got those manuals, and started studying them. One day I got caught taking apart that instrument because I wanted to see what the inside looked like. And I was violating the calibration sticker, and I was doing all kinds of things. I got chastised for that one. But they soon recognized that the curiosity of this guy, who eventually they found out was K2LIW, I hadn't yet written any good articles, but you know what I mean. I was a ham radio operator, and they found out the curiosity of this guy was to their advantage. Because eventually I took apart the circuits they were manufacturing and made suggestions for improvements. So I studied that Weinberg oscillator and found out how in the world did it create such a beautiful sine wave. I then started studying how did the audio distortion analyzer do its work. It's another Weinberg. The Weinberg itself gives you a null at the desired frequency. And how in the world can the null at the desired frequency make it operate at that frequency? And the answer is that's the one place where it has, exactly as I remember, 180 degrees of phase shift. And that's what the oscillator wants to see. It's a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And if the next thing you do is to study the Hewlett-Packard 415, standing wave ratio detector. It also contains a Wien bridge-like circuit tuned to exactly 1 kilohertz. Whenever you're putting a signal into a slotted line and you're using as the detector the Hewlett-Packard 415 standing wave ratio indicator, you must modulate the signal at exactly 1 kilohertz. Doesn't matter if you do it with sine wave, square wave, or whatever. There's got to be 1 kilohertz component to the amplitude modulation of the signal you put into a slotted line. And that Hewlett-Packard 415 is looking for a crystal detector video output of exactly 1 kilohertz, and it rejects everything else. Therefore, it knows exactly what you're doing inside that slotted line, and in theory is doing a very good job of rejecting any signal from the local broadcast station or the other signal generator that's 2 benches downrange and the guy's running it up at full blast. It ignores everything except the 1 signal going down the center of that slotted line that has 1 kilohertz of amplitude modulation. It rejects everything else. Another Wien bridge circuit. Boy, they do a lot of magic. Very simple. 2 resistors and 2 capacitors, as I remember. But it's a 4-sided circuit that gives you a null across the opposite 2 nodes of the circuit. You study bridge circuits, and you study in particular the Wien bridge type bridge circuit. And there's about 10 or 15 kinds of bridges, but Wien bridge is the most famous one. You study the way it works. And that knowledge that I got in 1958, studying how Hewlett-Packard did that at Telefonic Corporation, let me drop. That allowed me to make a Wien bridge nulling circuit, not at 1 kilohertz, but I did it exactly 1.000 megahertz. That allowed me to build a synchronous detector that allowed me to measure very small amounts of picofarads. 5 zeros and a 5 was the number of picofarads I could resolve with that Wien bridge circuit into a synchronous demodulator. That circuit measured such a small amount of capacitance running at 1 megacycle that when I had it sitting on a wooden bench in the middle of a room and 10 feet away a human being came through the door, I could sense the change in the capacitance in the room 10 feet away because that human being was moving toward me. By measuring the amount of capacitance between 2 probes that were an inch apart on the table, on a wooden table, study what that circuit was doing. I was counting 19 electrons on each half cycle. With a Wien bridge detector and a synchronous demodulator, you can do that. How can such a simple circuit make that kind of sensitivity? That's a mind blower. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Well, that just goes to show you when the bridge is balanced, how critical it is. And back in those days, we had microfarads you were measuring before they started changing it all around on us. But and that distortion analyzer you were using was probably an HP 335, if I remember correctly. And that was an excellent device.
I remember what it looks like, but I forgot the model number. And by the way, Hewlett-Packard later on came out with a number of distortion analyzers, and the one that's really good is the one that can measure SINAD. The SINAD distortion analyzer. Boy, I think it's called the 330 or something like that. What an excellent machine that is. And you have that kind of high-quality stuff. I wonder if you own, I think it's a Model 330 HP SINAD distortion analyzer. Over to you, John. K2LAW.
Dick, I know I have a 335, I believe it is, which is similar to the one you were... I don't know if it's SINAD, though. I think it's too old. SINAD is within the last 20 years, is it not?
Hey, time goes kind of fast for you and I. I'll bet you SINAD was first used 30 years ago, John. But yes, it is a slightly more modern way. We used to measure 20 decibels of quieting of an FM receiver in order to measure its apparent sensitivity. 20 dB of quieting. And 12 dB of SINAD does a much better job, much more exacting of the way real... I mean, I could get 20 dB of quieting, but of what's left over, audio circuit going into the loudspeaker or into the earphones happens to have a lot of audio distortion, then all of a sudden I can't understand the human voice anymore, what he's saying. So the SINAD meter doesn't measure only sensitivity, it measures a combination of sensitivity plus audio distortion. It really measures the intelligibility of your receiver for a threshold circuit. So it's a much more thorough test, even though it's done in one swell swoop of a simple measurement on that slightly more complicated distortion analyzer. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
KD2AOC, comment?
AOC recognized. Yeah, Dick, there's so many interesting instruments, and most people don't have them available to them to even play with or to see what they can do. But, yeah, you can do some real interesting things. The gentleman that owns this 200 audio oscillator, I tried to impress on him what a state-of-the-art that thing was, and today it is still rated as a great oscillator. They have new ones, and they're fairly stable, but they're not that much better than that original one. And that's a throwback that still can function and serve you well. That's how I feel. KC2WGB. Pick up the station, Dick.
KD2AOC is Dennis from Cutchogue. How in the world, way out there on the North Fork of Long Island, does he get a signal all the way back to us from Never Never Land? You're out there in the tule weeds, as I see it, Dennis, and I know you're using a very good antenna, and you and Jay, K2OBS, NY2NY, did that. Go ahead with your question or comment, Dennis. KD2AOC, K2RIW.
Thank you, Dick. Thank you, John. What I wanted to ask, I find it fascinating what you're talking about, absolutely fascinating. But have you been getting the station that's been stepping on the transmissions on your end, or am I just hearing it out by me? Is it somebody who's doing it out here and I'm hearing it? Because they seem to be decimating what the conversations are, and they seem to do it at a precise time when you really want to keep tune in on the information being told. Over.
Right now, Dick, we're trying to restrict information.
Yeah, there is a disgruntled individual, John, that's intentionally trying to make life difficult, and a certain amount of what's being said is not coming through. Both the main repeater on the western end and to sometimes a greater degree the repeater on the eastern end. Circuitry is being assembled that's going to eventually stop that from happening. But this particular individual has been creating this kind of grief for a couple of years. I'm speculating he's a rather unhappy person. I'm guessing that he's living with his mother. He's out of work because he's doing it all kinds of hours of day and night. He's got nothing better to do with his time. He's a sad case, and he won't be doing it too much longer. I know you've got to put up with some grief along the line for the time being, Dennis. KD2AOC. Have anything they heard so far created any questions for you? KD2AOC, K2LAW.
I just love the conversations on this TechNet. It's just fascinating. There's tons of questions, but, you know, it's so far above my level at this point that I just sit here in awe and I listen to it. I was fascinated by the microwave discussion as to how it works. I never really gave it much thought until you really put it into perspective. KD2AOC, over.
Yeah, bear in mind, Def, what you're hearing when I give an explanation of microwaves and how a microwave oven works. Okay. For a while there, it wasn't coming through. My understanding of microwaves is my own personal understanding that you're hearing, John. And you won't see it, to my knowledge, written that way in any of the books that I know about. my passion, my raison d'etre, my reason for existence has been microwave for the last, ever since 1960. Jay KQOVS in 1959 loaned me a Amico 6-meter converter, New Vista converter. He doesn't realize what a change that made in my life. I was a 40-meter CW operator before that. He loans me the 6-meter converter. I start listening around and say, boy, 6 meters is an exciting place to be. And I went and built myself a 6-meter synthesized solid-state transmitter, my first major product with transistors, major project with transistors, roughly 1961. Let me drop. And I've been a VHFer ever since. Oh, I've got some HF capability, but I use it 2% of the time, so to speak. So Jay created that. I'm not sure he ever got that 6-meter New Vista converter back. I don't think he did. I think it's still in my basement. But the word microwave is very relative. But any of these things that you hear, any of these things that you read, the hard thing to recognize in college is that the first time you hear new information you're not familiar with, it'll scare you. It doesn't make sense. You have to keep rereading it 2, 3, 4, 5 times. You got to talk to somebody. Jay and I and two other very smart guys formed at Princeton what we called the study group. So we got together for a couple of nights before each exam that was being given in electrical engineering. And by discussing it back and forth, somewhat like going on the TechNet right now, eventually some of this esoteric material started making some sense. Not all of it. So the fact that you're hearing new material and it snows you at first, believe it or not, although you're frustrated, that's a good sign. If you're frustrated, you're probably learning. If the material is very familiar and you're comfortable, well, to a certain degree, you already knew it and no progress is being made. So you should left-handedly be a little bit happy about the fact that you're frustrated. Hang in there. Listen to it 2 or 3 more times. Take the individual words that don't make sense. Let me drop.
And ask questions.
You've got it. Ask questions and or look up those words on the internet. There is an amount of information on the internet these days that's just out of sight, as I usually say. You do enough searching on the internet on just how two different sine waves will mix together in a mixer circuit and make harmonics and make the intermodulations and make the plus and minus IF frequency. You will find a three-dimensional applet, a moving diagram that will show you dynamically on your computer screen what you would have seen on a really high-quality oscilloscope if you were looking at the operation of a circuit. There are things on the internet these days that you can find that no good book in the library has yet, if you know what I mean. So hang in there, Dennis. It'll eventually make sense. And choose the individual area of esoteria that you think you're interested in and dig in. That's a suggestion. KD2AOC, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
And 2APG.
I meant to say Dennis. And Dave recognized. We'll pick you up in a second. Go ahead, Dennis.
Oh, actually, I'm not frustrated. I'm extremely challenged. I find it all very fascinating. You know, like a sponge, you want to soak it in, but you can't soak it in quick enough. When you were talking about Pratt, did you mean the times when the Ford used to get rolled in and like that? And as far as what I'm using, because you remarked on the booming signal, Jay tuned the Cushcraft Wingo, and I'm using a Kenwood 731A as the mobile base, just to give you some insight to what I'm using. Over.
That Kenwood 731A, let me double check. Yeah, mine's a 751A, so I'm not familiar with the 31A. But the mobile Kenwood 751A is my favorite 2-meter all-mode mobile rig. And it's got a couple of quirks. It's got to see exactly 12.0 volts or greater, and it dies in the sideband mode. So when your automobile engine is not running and the battery goes down to 12 volts, and after voltage drop, you got 11.8 volts going to the radio, and you try to run it in the sideband mode, it gives you all kinds of funny glitches. That's the one thing I don't like about it. And there's ways around it, but it's not easy. Dave, N2APG, go right ahead. And you may have heard that I've acquired another telescope. But I haven't come up to your level yet, Dave. N2APG, KQRIW. Oh, I don't know. I think maybe you surpassed me. I was just checking my records through N2APG, and it seems to me that this acquisition of the new telescope, this is very big news, because according to my records, the last telescope purchase that you made was August 2nd, 1986, and that was a Celestron, an 8-inch Celestron. So if possible, could you give us some more information, some specifications, some details on this new acquisition?
Let me think now. You think it was 86? No. Now, I retired from the first company, A.R. Bernstrom's Laboratory, in 2000. I think I acquired that scope a couple of years before retiring. Very close to 1998 is the 8-inch Celestron. Now, the new one is a 4.5-inch Newtonian-like. It's a Celestron brand name, but it's Newtonian with eyepieces that give you an upright picture, so you can use it terrestrially as well as celestially. It's a much smaller telescope than the 8-inch. And the reason I acquired it is it's got a lot lighter, greater portability. The good news about the 8-inch is it's got fantastic resolution. The bad news is it's 75 pounds of hardware. And so moving it around, it ain't easy. But my life is a hell of a lot easier than what John, I can't think of John's last name right now, the guy at the Astronomical Society of Long Island that homebrewed his own 31-inch Newtonian telescope, a Dobson, and you have to stand on a 12-foot A-frame ladder just to get up to the eyepiece of that telescope. It takes a parachute to get back down. So, and that is a portable telescope. So he puts me to shame when it comes to portability. Let me drop it. So now my new one is smaller just for portability, John. And the price is right. I mean, Dave. You've got a lot more binoculars than I do. I might have more telescopes than you, but I'm not sure. N2APG, KQRIW.
Okay, very good. We'll have to do a little research and see what that telescope looks like. I'm not familiar with the complete Celestron telescope line at the present time, but it sounds like a nice little package. And I know that you would not have picked it up if you weren't satisfied that it had some pretty good quality optics and stuff like that. So we'll have to check that out. So very fine. I was amazed. I said, is he kidding me? He's going to mention on the TechNet that he's acquired a new telescope and he's just going to leave us hanging? I said, impossible.
Yeah, KG2T. He gets out in the morning and describes astronomy operations he goes through. And he's got a telescope. I think it's Celestron, and his is 11 inches, if I remember. And I believe it's like 150 pounds of hardware. He's got a lot more telescope than I do. I don't think he's got quite as much portability. But I believe he does have the ability to take it apart into pieces, put it in his automobile, and drive it out to the Custer Institute if he wants to. Or I think he does drive it out to the planetarium in Centerport. I can't think of the name of it. The Vanderbilt Planetarium. I should know about that. I live on Vanderbilt Parkway. All right, the Vanderbilt Planetarium. One or two Wednesdays per month when they have a an observing session, and he occasionally brings his, I believe it's 11-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope, Celestron brand, and he bought it with all the goodies. He's pretty serious. And if you go to his website, KG2T, he'll show you pictures of his telescope and the pictures he's taken through it with his astrophotography camera. There are people in their backyard nowadays that can take, with modern-day equipment, take pictures that Mount Palomar 30 years ago would be proud to be able to publish. And there are guys in their backyard that can now do it with more modern equipment.
Palomar, of course, is now doing better also with fancy detectors. So the word telescope is a very relative thing. But the king of telescopes on Long Island is John, I can't think of John's last name, from the Astronomical Society in Long Island. He's a Huntington resident, and he built a homebrew 31, or was it 33? I think it's a 31-inch, and he had to build it twice because the mirror cracked somewhere in the production process the first time. Can you...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Can you imagine grinding your own 31-inch mirror to a 20th of a wavelength accuracy? We're talking about micro-inch accuracy of all of the area of a 31-inch diameter piece of glass. I'm not sure, but I'll bet you that piece of glass weighs 150 pounds. Can you imagine the amount of tender, loving care and effort required? That's a real labor of love, and doing it twice. You're a guy with a lot of enthusiasm. Do you think you've got enough enthusiasm to do that, Dave, and to APG, K2LAW? I'll stick to my binoculars, Dick. In a quick answer, no, absolutely not. I don't have the patience. I want something that I can pick up, look through, and enjoy quickly too. Yeah, I've met a number of guys that have ground their own mirror, and when you decide you're going to build a telescope, as opposed to just writing a check and buying one. Even though when you decide to build a telescope, you can go out and buy the mirror, or you can build the mirror, grind your own mirror. And when you're at that crossroad of making that decision, you have to decide, what is your end product? If your end product is to look through a good telescope, and as long as you're not a poor person, you write a check and you buy the mirror. Because with half a week's salary, you can buy a mirror that's going to take you 2 years of your life to build. So if you just want to look through a telescope, buy the mirror, even if you're homebrewing everything else. If you enjoy the grinding process, the magic of how moving in a certain way around a barrel for hours on end just generates this quasi-spherical shape, which would then, with doing some figuring and some fancy measuring, you eventually convert it into a parabolic mirror shape. The grinding process itself is a real deep art form, and there are people who enjoy the daylights out of that and watching it happen and watching their children watch it happen. So you can enjoy the process or you can enjoy the end product. If it's the end product you want, either buy the Holdon telescope or at least buy the mirror. The rest of it is fairly easy to build. That's a bunch of opinions. Okay. John, is it time we go into gun safety? What do you think? Or do you want to, did you find something else in the mailbag that you think we should address? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I had a comment about the subject that I discussed before in Tuesday.
Yeah, let me hit John first. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. No, we just about covered the mailbag, but I have an interesting question for you. Now, I did two mirrors walking the barrel routine. They were only 8-inch mirrors. His mirror cracked, more than likely, when he was trying to remove it from the cutting stone, the cutting glass, because as you get that shape, you get that suction that happens, and if you lift it improperly, especially a mirror of that diameter, that's probably how he cracked it. Is that true?
I think the instant of the crack follows what you just described. But he did discover with a little further study that there was a flaw in the way it was built in the first place. I think he had signed a contract with, what the heck's the name of the company in Upper New York State that makes glass?
Glenn.
Yes. Let me drop. He signed a contract with Corning to build him the 31-inch mirror blank. And he described exactly how he wanted the hexagonal holes cut into it and everything else. And during the grinding process, he had to put the right kind of a vacuum pump across the hexagonal holes in the back in order to compensate for the pressure he was creating with the grinding process that was pushing down on the glass up front and deflecting it. He had to compensate for the deflection he was creating by the grinding process in order to make it come out right. And there was a flaw in the original. It hadn't been cooled slow enough. The annealing process, after they made the chunk of glass for him, the annealing process hadn't been done slow enough. There was a flaw in it. It had a strain. It had a weak spot, you could say. And so, with a fairly minor amount of the stitching problem you described, it cracked. And he had to go back to them, and I think he had to sign another contract to have them grind another mirror, build another mirror for him. And what did he do with the first one? It's an interesting question. Did he hand the glass back to them to melt it down? I'm not sure. I'll have to ask John next time I see him. Or if you get a hold of KG2T, who probably sees John periodically. John, the guy with the big telescope at Astley. I think that is the largest Newtonian. Yes, a Newtonian. The largest Newtonian telescope on Long Island that's either in private hands or, let me call it, quasi-commercial hands. I think there were very few. Let me drop. There may not be another telescope on Long Island that's bigger than 31-inch. He may be the king of the hill, if you know what I mean. So everybody knows who John is. I believe John sells insurance. So interesting hobby he's got compared to his occupation. Fascinating guy to talk to. And from time to time, he'll give a little presentation. He'll show you the movies or the pictures that he took during the process of building that scope with the Dobson mount. And the Dobson mount has got automatic motors that it does the automatic tracking and the taking out the Earth's curvature, the Earth's rotation and so on. Beautiful piece of hardware, and it's portable. And he's got a specially made vehicle he can wheel this into after he takes it apart. From the time that he arrives at the site and starts taking these parts and assembling it, I think it's around a 45-minute or 1-hour process when he goes from the automobile arriving at the site until you're ready to look through the eyepiece. I think it's about 45 minutes to an hour. But very interesting machine. It's got all of these tubular struts along the side that hold the 45-degree mirror and the eyepiece way out in front of this mirror. It's not a solid piece of tubing. He's lightened it up in various ways. And it's all got proper indexing, so everything goes together just right. A beautiful piece of work. For homebrew, when he goes to cellophane with that thing, he's a major attraction as I see it. You and I have never been to cellophane, Dave. Someday we've got to do that. That's the mecca of homebrew telescope makers. I wonder if you've ever been tempted into APG, K2LAW. Well, I remember as a teenager looking through the Sky and Telescope magazines that I subscribed to, and of course every year, you know, they had cellophane. So, no, I've never been there. Let's go, maybe this year. Yeah, I think it's the later half of summer when that conference takes place up there. Cellophane, Vermont. I think it's the name of the town or name of the facility. Somewhere in the Vermont area where really dark skies exist. And if you're lucky enough to get there on a day that's got not an overcast or a rainy sky during the four or five days of that conference, some really good viewing. That and the guys at Astley also go out to, I think it's called Cherry Valley, Pennsylvania, another place that has been declared a dark area where for miles around they've controlled whether or not there's, you know, a supermarket parking lot with lights and whatever. They've controlled that. By the same token, out at the Custer Institute in Southold, the Southold mayor, a very nice lady who's a ham radio operator and a member of the Peconic Amateur Radio Club. In fact, I think she was a past president. She, the mayor of the town of Southold, makes sure that around the Custer Institute, this major optical telescope, let me drop it. This major optical telescope facility, she makes sure that no extraneous light hits the atmosphere in that area so that they've got good observing. The Custer Institute has existed since the late 30s. and I believe one of them members at one time is some guy called Albert Einstein, and they used to have their own mirror grinding laboratory, but I don't think they do very much of that anymore. But they do a lot of other interesting things. They hold a couple of conferences per year. Wes, you had a question. N2XJN, K2LIW.
N2XJN. I was thinking about the cosmic rays, and there is an interesting phenomenon that is being known as GZK limit, where the cosmic ray particles with these ultra-high energies should be interacting and canceling out with the cosmic radiation background over the long distances. So not only should they not exist, but even if they did, which they do, we should not be seeing them at all. And so we're talking about the canceling of them. Let me jump. Because some cosmic rays are so energetic, they defy certain explanation. And I definitely, we had an on the technical speculation, where they come from. There is some information which explains that they come from nearby galaxies, supermassive black holes. What puzzles me is that if they are so energetic, they are like bullets. They're striking the body and say 30 cosmic rays per second. So the saturation is very big. And if they really possess, as the literature say, the 40 million times more energy than energy that we could achieve in the European accelerator, then that should be a way to extract that energy. Interesting.
I'm going to jump from that one to something similar, Wes. The total amount of energy in one single lightning bolt would light all of the lights in your town for a good fraction of a year. To extract that energy from a lightning bolt is extremely difficult. You have to be in the right place at exactly the right time with the right impedance match of the right energy storing equipment. To do that on something that's so random, there may be a lightning bolt. The one thing you can predict is lightning bolts are going to strike the Empire State Building. And yeah, you could build some kind of an energy detector there. But to try to absorb the energy of a lightning bolt, which is an average one, is 11,000 amperes for 20 microseconds. It's sort of like using a machine gun in a library. The average noise is small, but the peak energy is huge. To gather instrumentation on the top of the Empire State Building to gather that energy would be very difficult. Cosmic rays, when they're in free space, as they enter our solar system, let me drop, they experience a lot of the solar wind. All of those particles being boiled off by our sun, tons and tons of them every second are boiled off by the sun, and they're moving away at multiple millions of miles an hour. The cosmic rays have to go through that cloud of solar wind to get to our planet. When they get to our planet, they experience what they think is a pretty large magnetic field of our planet. They get deflected by that. They get deflected by the solar wind. They come down to our atmosphere, and they get deflected by the individual molecules of our atmosphere. The actual cosmic ray in space is so much more energetic than what gets down to the surface of the Earth. I don't know the exact number, but if I had to estimate, I'll bet you the combination of our magnetic field and our Earth's atmosphere is attenuating those cosmic rays by 60 decibels before it gets to you in Queens, Long Island, or to me in Huntington, Long Island. It's a big attenuator out there. You talk to any of the astronauts, let me drop. You talk to any of the